question. I have already experienced more today than I have in my whole life. This might be the kind of action where you have to defend yourself. You've done that before, haven't she?
Once or twice. So much energy, though.
Don't worry about energy. I'm going to give you all you need. Just make sure whatever ye see goes down instead of you. Those claws of yours can do some real damage if you put some muscle behind it. Move fast as you can and don't give anything the chance to hurt ye.
What are we gonna fight?
We'll find out soon enough. The elemental tells me where to go. It's a decent jog of a couple miles, because there aren't any tethered trees closer than that. But after only a wee while, Slow-Mo asks if she can follow along in the trees. We're running through some woods that are close enough to allow swinging in the branches, and she argues that it'll probably be a smoother ride for both of us. I agree. And the weight soon lifts from me back, and she hoots as she takes to the branches, her long arms propelling her from tree to tree. "Have fun, but try to do it quietly," I says. "We don't want to announce that we're coming." The objective, I'm told, is to close a portal to the Christian hell that someone has managed to open. Hell was supposed to stay out of this fight, I thought, but some gobshite didn't get that particular memo. Which means I have to deal not only with whatever's coming out of that portal, but with whatever sorcerer had the moxie to open it. Perhaps I'll get lucky and find that the sorcerer got eaten by what came out of hell. Sheehan's stories about it suggest that happens as often as not.
There are lights and grunty fighty sounds ahead, Oaken,
Slow-Mo tells me. Why? After a moment I see and hear them too. I'm glad you're in the trees. Stay up there unless you have good reason to come down. I'm a bit more worried about her being here than I was before, because Sheehan's stories about hell are flooding back, and they're not the shiny, happy sort. I've never had to deal with a Christian hell myself, because that whole religion came along and flourished while I was stuck on that time island. The day Sheehan told me the Christians drove the Druids out of Ireland, and then the Irish wound up killing one another over different versions of Christianity centuries later, was an especially dark stretch of a dark feckin' day. A notable detail about the religion is how much effort is spent on imagining eternal punishments after death. Plenty of faiths have richly imagined hells, Sheehan assures me, but apparently the Christian one deserves the biggest slice of bread pudding at the end of the night. So many demons and devils, eager to torture souls, so eager in fact that they want to trade for them and are willing to deal with sorcerers to get what they want. More deaths, more corrupted souls. And should they be set loose on this plane, they will never hesitate to kill anything living, in hopes that it might increase their own power, especially since it reinforces the idea that they are hellish and to be feared, a circular thought pattern within the faith that they exploit. It's no place for a sloth to be dangling around. I come to a small clearing in the forest that's been turned into a battlefield with multiple light sources. One of them is the moon and stars above. There's an orange-red glow coming from the open portal to hell, which is rapidly draining the elemental's energy, the entire reason I've been called. But there are also other lights, purple cones surrounding 13 women as they battle the horrors coming out of hell, and the white light of whips they are using like scourges to banish the horrors from this plane. I have to stop to take it all in, because it is intense and alarming as a chopped ghost pepper poultice applied directly to the genitals, with forethought and malice. What I'm seeing fits with stories Sheehan has told me before. These must be the Polish witches he told me about, the sisters of the three Auroras, who derive their powers from goddesses called the Zorias. The purple cones surrounding them are protective wards, and those weapons they're lashing around are hell whips, and that smell is entirely from hell.
Oaken, something smells really bad, like even worse than jaguar poots.
Slow-Mo says,
and in case you didn't know, there is no poot in the world worse than a jaguar poot.
I filed that information away to share later with Granuel. That's the demons. Stay away from them, all right? If any come near, I want you to get away if you can. Take off their heads if you can't.
Which are the demons?
The ones that smell bad and try to kill ye.
Got it.
The sorcerer is on the far side of the portal. Some sad, scabby punk of a lad who thinks the world owes him something, and he's come to collect. I put on me brass knuckles and call out the name I remember from Shia Han's stories, the leader of the coven, if I'm not mistaken. Melina! Can I help? Most of the witches do not react, but one of them looks in my direction after finishing off some monstrosity that looks like an ambulatory slime mold with eyes.
Who are you?
She shouts, backing up and flailing the hell whip around in front of her in a defensive pattern. She has long, straight, blonde hair falling over her shoulders, most likely the finest hair I've ever seen in my whole life. And like the rest of her coven, she's dressed in something black that I suspect must be fashionable these days. I don't know how to describe it in modern terms, but basically, if I were a wee lass, I would look at Melina and want to grow up to be her someday. And even as a grown man, I'm more than a bit sad that I will never, ever look as good as she does destroying evil. Kind of glad, actually, that me young apprentices aren't here to see this, or else they might not want to be druids anymore. Owen Kennedy! Druid of Gaia! The man who taught that O'Sullivan lad! She squints at me for a moment, probably confirming that I have the requisite tattoos and am bound to the earth. And then she nods.
If you can take out the sorcerer, that would be helpful.
Helpful, she says. That would end the whole feckin' game, the way I see it. But it's not the sort of thing to raise a fuss about. I'm here to close that portal, and everything else is a distant second to that. I just don't want to get mistaken for an enemy in this bloodbath and get lashed with one of their hell whips. We circle around to the left, running clockwise, as they say, and plow me fist through the face of something orange and toothy that tries to stop me. It explodes under the knuckles and falls over in a shower of its own ichor. But that only draws the attention of four more horrors. I realize that none of them are flying, and I might be able to avoid some messy bollocks by shifting shapes. I strip off me shirt and shift to a red kite, soaring above the demons and circling around behind the sorcerer. The clever bindings Crania worked into me knuckles mean the brass has flowed down to me talons, and I'm thinking, as I glide behind the sorcerer, that it's going to be so easy to simply latch onto his neck from behind, clutch and tear away his throat. Easiest mission of the whole day, and on top of that, I get to look cool in front of the cool kids of the coven. Except it doesn't work out that way. Nope. Instead, I run into an invisible wall, like a feckin' dumbass sparrow assaulting a glass door, and flail in a mess of feathers, head buzzing from the impact, until I hit the dirt outside a ring of salt. Ah, the protective ring. That's what happened to me. When I'm shape-shifted, I'm precisely the sort of thing the sorcerer's wards are designed to keep out. The ring detects the magical aura of my bound shape and denies me access. Well, lad, good on you. But I can shift back to human and obliterate your feckin' salt, can't I? I perform the shift and grunt, and he hears it. He whirls around, and it's a face of blue-eyed madness I see. Paranoid testosterone that's been let out of the barn. Some young punk who's either never had the shite beat out of him so he doesn't understand that there'll be consequences for his actions, or who's been beaten so much and so badly he doesn't give a blistered tit what happens to him next. His puck says the babe is swaddled in poison ivy and is incensed about it as you might expect. He shouts something at me, in Polish, I suppose, and I don't understand a word of it, but I sure feel whatever it is he casts my way. His hand thrashes and clutches, and I suddenly feel like all me muscles are clenching at once, except for me arse, which is relaxing at precisely the wrong time. It hurts more than anything is rightfully supposed to. And I can't think of what to do except to cast healing on myself before it kills me. I'm spraying shite around the forest, thinking this is not the way I wanted to die, and also that maybe Sheon had a point about the uses of cold iron. When something savage bugles above me head, I throw up a forearm, hoping to protect myself from whatever it is. But it turns out that it's not some hellspawn come to snack on me spleen. I'm not even the target. That would be the poxy sad sack who's draining Gaia with his festering hellhole. It's Slow-mo Nomo Broderly, leaping down from high up a tree to grasp onto the lad with one long arm around the back of the neck while she plunges the three long claws of her right hand directly into the blackguard's throat. She rips up and out, screaming in his face, and he manages a panicked gurgle and a surprised pair of eyes before he topples backward, ruining his salt circle and breaking who knows how many concurrently running spells. I guess the binding I used to give Slow-mo her energy wasn't enough magic to trigger his protective ward. All I know for sure is that I'm grateful to get control of me own arse again while the rest of me relaxes. The lad was keeping the portal open through force of his own will, and with that gone, the portal closes on its own. That doesn't mean it's all over, though. There's still plenty of hellspawn out there, and the sudden scent of spilled blood in the air has drawn them in our direction, rather than toward the unspilled blood of the witches. Melina and some of the others snag a few of them, but that still leaves at least three pelting toward the body of the sorcerer, and me favorite killer sloth is sitting right on top of him. Slow-mo! Back to the trees! Fast! Climb high! Hurry! I quite nearly shite myself again out of fear that I may have placed her in harm's way. I haven't even had time to properly appreciate that she just saved me ancient bones, and here she is in peril as a result. One of the things coming at her is mostly teeth and stomach, propelled by four legs underneath that look like an insect's, bending up and out and clawed at the feet. Another is a slimy red glob of a thing, oozing far too quickly our way, with a tongue questing for fresh meat to wrap up and pull into its dark, moist mouth. The last demon looks like an angry avocado that's sworn to get revenge for all the world's guacamole, and it's moving the fastest. I scramble to me feet, intercepted as Slow-mo leaps to the nearest tree trunk. She's digging in with those claws and doing the best she can, but the damn avocado is zeroed in on her. It realizes at the last second that I'm not racing to beat it to the meal on the tree, but I'm racing to pound its lumpy face instead. It tries to hiss and snarl to intimidate me, but I'm not the type that responds well to that bollocks. When I plough me fist between its eyes, I discover that it's nothing like an avocado at all. It's more like a bag of something caustic that latches onto me skin and burns, and even though it falls over and melts into goo, I'm left with something burning away at me arm. I holler about it as the tongue from the other horror wraps around me midsection and yanks me through the air to its mouth. I make sure it gets a taste of me burning slime-covered arm first, and when everything goes hot and wet and dark, I shape-shift to a bear and start lashing about with me claws. It can't barf me out fast enough, and I wind up clawing me way out of something dead and melting around me. These demons don't last long on this plane once you've destroyed what little shred of force is keeping them bound together. That's probably why those hell whips of the witches are so effective. Melina demonstrates by lashing through the stomach of the toothy thing that's snacking on the remains of the sorcerer. It screams and dissolves into a mess on top of him, and I check to see that Slow-mo is safe before assessing what other threats might be around. You did good, lass. Are you hurt?
I'm fine, Oaken. A bit shocked at how mad I got when that human was trying to hurt you, but otherwise, okay. Are you all right?
Nothing wrong with me that can't heal eventually, I says, and in truth, I already have that in progress. As much to test for damage as anything else. Whatever's burning me hasn't damaged the integrity of my tattoos, thank the gods below. Where'd you learn to take someone down like that? I ask Slow-mo.
Oh, watching jaguars hunt. They either leap on something and just bite through the head into the brain because their jaws are really that strong. Or they go for the throat. Quickest way to end it.
I turn to see if there's anything else to worry about, but there's not so much as an angry gnat around. The portal's closed and harmony's restored. The witches have taken care of the rest of the hellspawn, but they're sure giving me the doubtful glare, muscles tense, and weapons at the ready in case I turn on them. Probably because of the bear thing. I get that a lot. Shifting back to human, I wave my uninjured hand at them to show them I'm friendly. I sure can't be hiding any weapons in me clothes, because I don't have any. They don't seem concerned with that at all. I think they're more interested in the ease of the shift itself than in what I've shifted to. I do notice that they're keeping their wards up. Owen Kennedy! I call to them because no doubt several of them missed it when I first arrived. Druid of Gaia! I was called here to close the portal, so that's done. Thanks for your help!
Melina Sokolovska,
the blonde woman says with a charming accent.
Leader of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. May I ask what's killed the sorcerer? I was occupied and didn't see clearly.
Oh, that was a sloth.
A sloth? You have to be joking. There are no sloths around here, and they don't move that fast.
She came with me, and they can move that fast when you give them enough energy. One of the other witches titters. She has long blonde hair as well, but it's pulled back and bundled up on top of her head. She also wears a pair of enormous eyeglasses. Melina turns to see what's so funny, and the witch says,
We did see something in the divination that hinted at unexpected aid. I think a pumped-up murder sloth qualifies as unexpected.
The whole coven either smiles or chuckles at this. Divination, eh? Is that what has ye out here in the woods? I ask.
It is. We're aware something truly frightening is going on in Sweden, but we wanted to address local threats. We've been keeping an eye on that guy for a while,
she says, flicking a finger at the body.
And we saw that he planned to take advantage of the chaos elsewhere to further his own agenda.
And what agenda would that be? Who was he? Melina shrugs.
Another man who wanted to climb to power on a ladder of violence.
Well, I'm not one of those, if you want to relax. I mean ye no harm. She nods at me once, and drops her wards. The others follow her lead, and one on the fringes holds up my shirt.
Your clothes are over here, if you want to get dressed.
I don't, especially. I'd rather dive into a lake somewhere and clean up, but methinks they want me to, so I jog over there and shove me shanks into the jeans and pull on the shirt. I appreciate what you did here, taking care of all those beasties. That would have been a rough job to do by myself. So you're the coven Granuel has been studying Polish with?
That's right,
Melina says.
Would you be interested in learning the language also?
Well, perhaps someday, sure, I says. But I'm still working on English at the moment. She introduces the entire coven to me, and I'm subtly checking out auras as she does. They are no doubt assessing me as well. I've not had particularly good experiences with witches in the past. I've met more of the kind that behaved like the dead lad over there than the nurturing sort. But these don't have a trace of avarice or sullen resentment about them. Guile? Sure. But they're confident, and happy, and clearly more interested in protecting their people than exploiting them. It wasn't always that way with this coven, according to Sheehan, but even he admits that they have changed significantly since Melina took over. It reminds me how much awesome responsibility there is in being a leader and a teacher. And seeing them, and how powerful they are together, it gives me hope for what me grove of young druids could be one day. Of a sudden I feel a pang in me chest for them, and wish for nothing so much but to catch up with them, wherever they are now, and teach them something new. It's been one of me greatest pleasures, since I've come forward in time, to see the wonder light up their faces. And it's probably why I enjoy hanging out with Shlomo, too. She's seeing something new every moment she isn't dangling from a tree, and she loves it. Methinks I know why I find watching others learn to be so fulfilling now. Xi'an let me know pretty clearly that I could have been a better teacher to him back in the old days. It wounded me pride, sure. There's nothing I can do to fix that now. But what I can do is be a better teacher for the Grove. A far sight better. And so far, I think I'm pulling it off. It's a pleasure to meet you all. Where am I, do you mind me asking?
In the southeastern corner of Poland, near the border with Ukraine.
Roxana tells me she's the one with the glasses. Is there a lake nearby?
Lake Selina is only a few kilometers to the west. If you run that way, you can miss it.
Pretty big, eh?
Big enough for bath time, if that's what you have in mind.
Aye, there's that. Plus I want to show the sloth. She's never seen a lake, only rivers. Do you need me to bury the body or anything before I go?
No, we'll take care of all this.
Melina says, and I thank them again and say I look forward to meeting them in less dangerous circumstances before collecting slow-mo from where she dangles and heading west a wee bit. As soon as we're out of sight, I strip again and shift to a bear, consigning those soiled clothes to history. Dawn is coming, the dark sky edging to grey, and slow-mo climbs on me back. I give her a ride to the lake, which turns out to be a long, spidery thing that fills up some valleys by damming up a river on one side. Looks like lots of people enjoy boating on it, judging by all the moored craft I see along the shores. We pause while we're still a ways up a hillside, so that slow-mo can appreciate the sunrise hitting the surface and lighting up the hillsides opposite us.
Wow, Oaken, that's pretty. Does all that water just sit there?
It has some circulation. It does drain at one end somewhere. I want to go down there and have a swim. I have blood and shite and demon goo on me and I want it off. Want to come with me?
I don't like swimming,
she says.
But I'll go wash off the blood and stuff from my hands. I'm feeling a bit sad that I did that to him.
No need to feel sad. He saved me and the whole world a bunch of trouble. That lad wanted nothing but pain for everyone. And if he had given him a chance, he would have done the same to you. I start rambling downhill and slow-mo is silent, taking it all in, I suppose. But I can tell she's thinking, too. Finally, she says,
he did seem to be pretty mad about stuff, which is strange because there's so much to be happy about. I mean, even when you figure in toucans, this huge world is pretty awesome. Maybe he's happier being dead, in the sense that he's not angry about being alive.
Slow-mo's attempts to rationalize the sorcerer's death fascinate me because she's focusing not on my safety or hers, but rather on his happiness. I figure it's best to leave out the idea that his spirit is probably in the Christian hell now, and he's unlikely to be happy there. No way to know for sure, I says to her, but I'm sure looking forward to getting clean, and I'm happy to be here with you.
Me too, Oaken. You know what's strange?
What's that?
I wouldn't be here, looking at a lake, or seeing any of the things that I've seen recently, if that fireball hadn't almost killed me and awakened Pachamama. Strange how something so terrible can lead to something good afterward.
You're right, Slow-mo. I've been surprised by it, too. And that's no soft lie, I'm telling her. Had Gaia not been placed in so much peril, I wouldn't have seen as much of her as I have recently and learned to love her even more, even as I'm beginning to grasp the scope of the work we have to do to bring her back to something close to balance. Xi'an should take on a Grove of apprentices like mine, and Gronuaid too, when she feels ready. We need many more druids. Slow-mo no more broadly, climbs down off me back when we get to the shore. It's early enough that no one's around to marvel at the black bear and sloth on the shore. I wade on in and feel the insistent burn on me right forearm instantly cool down. Once I'm deep enough to feel me paws struggle to reach the bottom, I shift to human, take a startled gasp at the cold, and get myself all scrubbed. Slow-mo is less than expert at washing herself. Those claws are great for climbing trees, but do make softer tasks a bit troublesome. She's splashing around, rubbing her wrists awkwardly with the flat of her hands, but mostly she's getting frustrated. "Would you like some help getting your claws and arms clean? My fingers might be able to handle the job."
"Oh, sure, Oaken. That would be great. I want to be clean, but I'm not very good at staying that way."
"Not to worry. Ye just described the fundamental state of being for most of us."
Chapter 20. Before Briet's block of Fey can engage, the Olympians see room for sport between the flanks and swoop in to have their fun. And I do think they viewed it as fun, at least Zeus and Ares did, along with their Roman counterparts. The thunder gods flew down and hurled their gods of war at the mass of Draugr, which had no immediate effect since the Draugr allowed the armored bodies to pass through and roll on by. Ares and Mars came to a stop and began swinging huge maces around, sending some Draugr flying through the air, but not really ending any of them. They thought it all entertaining, depending on their armor to stop whatever attacks might get through their defenses. They were laughing. It was recreational for them, since they felt they had nothing to lose. They couldn't die, really. Once their injuries became catastrophic, they would vacate their flesh and regenerate upon Olympus. Zeus and Jupiter didn't deign to land and get involved. They just floated out of reach and smiled at Ares and Mars playing around. Athena and Minerva had not come to play, however, and neither had the Apollos. They went to work behind the others. The goddesses worked with bronze-tipped spears and the gods with shields and swords, thrusting blades through Draugr faces and cutting down reanimated Fey. They'd been brought to the front by Hermes and Mercury, who dropped them off and then sailed over the Draugr, wearing some strange goggles, scouting ahead for something, presumably to find where Hel and Loki had hidden themselves in the Horde. Perhaps that's what Zeus and Jupiter were waiting for, a true target worthy of battle. They wanted to skip the minions and proceed directly to the boss fight, because there were Girl Scout cookies on the line. I'm not sure Hermes and Mercury were up to the task, though. Maybe those goggles would allow them to see through illusions, and maybe not. The Romans had used something like that to deconstruct camouflage and find the druids in the old days, some invention of Minerva's. But seared into the flesh of both Loki and Hel was his mark, some sort of runic protection from divination that had obviously kept them hidden very well to this point, and Loki was a master of disguise. I doubted Minerva had come up with something to pierce his protections. Unless those goggles showed them the magical spectrum, that would be the key to finding them both. But neither the Norse nor the Olympians were renowned for magical sight. Odin typically needed to be seated on Hlidskjalf, the silver throne, to see all. Of those remaining on the field, only Briet and I had the ability to use it. Unless there were other members of the Tuatha De Dana in her army somewhere, my guess was that she left some behind in case she didn't return. I hadn't triggered my magical sight yet, because there was so much magic as well as actual gods flying around on the field that I figured it would be blinding. But it might also be the best way to end things. Taking out Hel would at least allow us to make significant progress against the Horde. Some of the slain Alfar were beginning to rise from the dead, and since I was near them, I needed to keep an eye out now for that as well as for the Draugr. I backed away from the fight somewhat before I switched my vision over. Being on the fringe and camouflaged allowed me that space. I triggered the charm on my necklace to the magical spectrum, and had to blink and squint to filter through what I was seeing. The Draugr had their own magic signature, and the Olympians were blinding white silhouettes off to the left. The Alfar, meanwhile, had plenty of magic baked into their armor. Except one of them, nearby, quite close by, had a whole lot of extra something going on. His was a shifting riot of colors, magically speaking, and I had only seen a signature like that once before. "Coyote?" I said. "Is that you?" The elf slid a spear neatly in and out of a Draugr's eye, and then turned to me with a smirk that was familiar even on another face. He slipped out of formation and came over to stand next to me, even though I was practically invisible.
"Sure is, Mr. Druid. Took you long enough to notice.
What are you doing?"
"Oh, just slaying the undead like one of them regular elves, looking down this long white nose at everybody, feeling fancy. Kind of wondering what these fellers use to wash their hair."
He looked down at the thick braid falling down his chest and sniffed.
Smells like pears or something.
"Maybe you could ask later. I was just going to try to find hell."
"Oh, you were. Might be able to save you a bit of trouble."
A draugr broke through the Alfar line and came after him, but he dodged the blow. I raised my blade, and he said,
No, don't kill it. I need one alive for a few seconds. Can you hold on to it?"
"For maybe a second. They're strong, and they can become incorporeal." Though, in truth, I had not tried to put one in a hammerlock yet. Perhaps my cold iron aura would interfere with its ability to go ghostly and would keep it solid.
"Try, will you?"
I dropped and swept the draugr's legs, a move it wasn't expecting at all, and it landed heavily on the ground. I stomped on the flat of its sword, pinning it to the ground to make sure it didn't go anywhere, and Coyote leaned over on the other side, grabbing the bony left hand as if he were going to help it get up. The draugr was clearly confused, since neither of us seemed ready to kill it, and its wonder grew as Coyote's appearance shifted and rippled from the hand, from that of an elf, to a draugr that looked exactly like the one we have on the ground, a perfect copy, down to the smell and the exposed innards kept in by a shredded curtain of muscle. The trickster even had the rusty chain armor and helmet, the ratty leather boots, and a scrap of something belted around the waist.
"Okay, Mr. Druid,"
Coyote's new voice rattled.
"You can kill it now."
I shoved Frogger into the thing's face, and it twitched once and expired. An ambitious elf, who saw the new draugr behind the lines, came over to take care of him, but I cried a warning, dropped my camouflage, and stepped in front of Coyote. I had to block a strike and shout in Old Norse before the elf got the idea he should stand down. "This one's on our side," I explained, leaving out that Coyote is not a draugr at all. "He's gonna lead us to hell and help us take her down, so she doesn't keep raising the dead." I half-turned to Coyote and muttered in English, "Smile and nod so he knows you're friendly." Coyote waved at the elf with a twinkle-fingered flutter and tried to smile with his ruined, half-rotted face. We wound up employing the elf to get us back through the line. I cast camouflage again and put a left hand on Coyote's shoulder as the elf led us to the front and made sure we didn't get cut down by any other elves. We were expelled into the horde, and the draugr ignored Coyote as one of their own, flowing around him and showing zero interest in why he was going the wrong way. I followed in his wake and asked him where we were going.
"Hell's up on the hill, where she can maintain a view. I can see her from here."
"You can?" To me, it was still a wash of magic, nothing distinct.
"Sure."
"Is Loki nearby?"
"He was earlier, but I don't see him now. Say, Mr. Druid, I've been wondering, if one of them purty elves back there eats a burrito and boots, you think it smells like buttercups or something?"
"That would require them to have floral agents in their intestines."
"You say that like they don't. Well, I bet they take supplements, poot supplements, to make them smell good. I want some so I can poot on people and have them compliment me on how fine it smells."
"It's good to have goals, Coyote."
"Heck yes. Fresh poot supplements would be a revelation if you made them available to humans. Folks would just be ripping poots in cars and elevators without fear of embarrassment because it would smell so fine. They'd probably eat more sauerkraut and beans. It would change the world and its standards etiquette. It might even become polite to poot on someone when you first meet them."
If that seemed like an odd conversation to have in the middle of a battle, it was because our progress against the tide of undead was less than swift. It gave Coyote time to share his theories about elf poots, and gave me plenty of time to look around and see the battle from the enemy's perspective. The forces defending humanity looked pitifully small. Odin had ordered the Vanir and Einherjar forward to reinforce the center and support the flanks as well, but it appeared that Thor was summoning mist around them to hide the gods from view. Why would he do that, unless the Norse had some way of seeing through it? My answer came, perhaps, a couple minutes later, after watching Briat's army meet the Draugr and do somewhat better. They were at least cutting down more Draugr than the others. The Yumen had come to the front and were taking plenty of punishment, while other Fae thrust forward with spears in between to slay the Draugr. Better tactics. Briat herself was fighting among them. The Olympians continued to run amok in the midst of the Draugr, thinking themselves invincible, until Loki struck back. Ares was the first to fall, with an impossibly well-placed arrow finding the eye slot in his helmet and piercing into his brain. Mars fell the same way seconds later, and that's when Zeus and Jupiter realized that this wasn't a playground. They scanned the slope of the volcano for the source of the arrows, and I suppose they found it, after a fashion, since they fell out of the sky with arrows protruding from their skulls, too. I wondered if, once they respawned back on Olympus, they would look back at their brief participation in this battle and recognize their hubris. They had done very little damage for having such great reputations. And that's when I remembered that Loki had stolen the lost arrows of Vayu from Granuaile in India, though I suppose now they must now be considered the found arrows. Those were long-distance god slayers, each of them enchanted to find its target, very similar to Odin's spear Gungnir, which always hit its target, or Thor's hammer Mjolnir. Hermes and Mercury went down next, having never found where Hel and Loki were hiding in the mob. At least the mist around the Norse gods made sense now. Loki couldn't target them if he couldn't see them. But neither could the Norse gods really let loose with the threat of those arrows out there. Loki had effectively neutralized them. Though he had really pissed off the remaining Olympians. Athena, Minerva, and the Apollos sped up their patient, workmanlike pace of battle to reckless abandon. If they were going to be taken down by arrows, too, they wanted to leave some mark on the field. But no further shafts appeared in godly skulls. Loki must have a limited supply, and he was almost certainly saving one for Odin. The ones he'd let fly, however, could be recovered and shot again. In the teeming mass of bodies, I couldn't see if any Draugr were currently bent to the task of recovering arrows, but Loki would be a fool not to at least make the attempt. If one of the Apollos, for example, got hold of one of those arrows, it could be employed against him. "Did you see where those arrows came from?" I asked Coyote.
"What arrows?" he rasped.
"The ones that killed the Olympians."
"What? I missed that."
"How could you miss that? He just removed six gods from the battlefield."
"Hey, it's real nice that you can just keep your hand on my shoulder and gawk at the show, Mr. Druid. But I'm trying to find a path forward and keep an eye on Hel, because I thought that's who we're after. Are you changing the plan on me now?"
"No, no, you're right. Sorry."
"Maybe you can give me a play-by-play,"
Coyote said.
"We're going to be at this for a while."
I reviewed the deity body count for him, and then took another look at the field to see how that was going. The Alfar are still essentially keeping it a stalemate on the right flank, but every time one falls, Hel raises it up. That doesn't appear to be the case with the Dark Elves on the left flank.
"No?
I don't see the Dark Elves shifting to smoke like they did at first. They probably realize they don't have to. They're naturally faster than the Draugr. But I've yet to see a Dark Elf raised from the dead. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? If they had a natural defense against necromancy?"
"It sure would. Sounds like the sort of thing you could bottle and sell. You'd make a fortune, and it would be the ultimate in late-stage capitalism. Protect yourself and your family from the apocalypse with Mr. Druid's anti-necromantic tonic and salubrious elixir. All of them doomsday preppers would buy a bottle and store it in their bunkers just in case. Huge part of the human economy is based on just in case, you know that? Insurance, condoms, diapers, It's all just in case.
I chuckled because it's difficult not to like Coyote, even when he might mess with you at any moment, and because I understood that he was nervous. Humor often shields the mind against fear. And we had plenty to fear ahead. The slope of the volcano was slowly coming into focus for me, and while I didn't see hell yet, I felt sure Coyote was right about her being there, because Garm, her hound, was standing sentinel. She would be somewhere nearby, probably not right next to him, but a few quick leaps away.
"That dog's gonna be a problem," Coyote said, saying aloud what I was already thinking. "That's the one that chased us all those years ago, am I right?"
"Yes, through the plains of the Dene."
"So he knows our scent. He's gonna smell us before we get in range. Or smell you, anyway. I copied the scent of this undead asshole. And let me tell you, Mr. Druid, I don't smell like pears and happiness no more."
"Yes, I've noticed that."
"More like prunes and despair," Coyote said.
"Well, which way is the wind blowing? Maybe he won't be able to pick me out of the crowd."
"Maybe. But once we do anything to hell, he's gonna come running regardless. We can deal with him before or after we attack hell. But one way or another, he's gotta be dealt with."
We moved in silence for a while, thinking, before I answered. "I don't really like the idea of hurting a dog. Even if it is a pretty mean one."
"I don't either."
"Is hell to the left or right of the hound?"
"Just to the left, in the center of the slope."
We were on the right side of the field. "How do you feel about circling around that way, coming at her from the left?" Coyote didn't reply for so long that I wondered if he'd heard me, but just as I was about to ask him again, he said,
"Way I see it. That plan has its good points and its bad ones, too. Might keep us from having to confront the dog right away. Might even allow us to get in and get out without confronting the dog at all. That's good."
"Agreed.
But that's gonna take a long time. Already taking us a long time as it is. Going straight ahead. Lots more folk gonna die. Loki's reloading."
"What? Where?"
"I don't know where he is yet. Still haven't spotted him. But off to the left, where you said those gods fell, there are Draugr moving toward the mountain like we are now. 6 of them. You said there were 6 gods that fell, right?"
"Yes."
"So we can follow them to Loki if you want, or keep doing what we're doing and deal with the dog somehow. Or turn left and try to circle around."
I still thought taking out Hel was more important than taking out Loki. She was the one replenishing their numbers with the Fallen, and therefore winning by attrition. I wasn't sure how much control over the Draugr Loki would have with her gone. If we were fantastically lucky, they would all return to her realm once she died. I didn't really think we'd be that lucky. But removing Hel from the battlefield would mathematically improve our chances the most. Loki might have the arrows of Vayu, but they were of such limited supply that he required a reload after 6 shots. Hel, on the other hand, could reanimate the flesh of nearly anyone who fell on the battlefield, as long as they still had a head, or apparently weren't one of the Svartalfar. "Let's keep heading down the highway to hell, so to speak." I got no response to this, not even a groan. So I sighed and mourned the wasted reference to AC/DC.
"What? Was that a pun or something, Mr. Druid? If it was, I'm sure it was terrible."
It undeniably was, but terrible puns were my specialty. Surviving was also my specialty, the sort of fact that's true until it abruptly isn't. If I wanted to survive this trip behind enemy lines, I should probably start worrying about my exit strategy, because killing Hel would doubtless evoke a response from Loki. A telltale chop to the air above drew my eyes to a couple of helicopters coming from the north, either the military or police forces of Sweden were a mite curious about all this brouhaha. Right now that pilot was trying to process what he was seeing and report it in a way that wouldn't get him a psych evaluation. The all-inclusive hostiles, I thought, would be the way to go, Tell him you see multiple hostiles of unknown origin fighting out there, and leave out the bit where there seem to be a whole lot of undead fighting against elves and dwarfs and possibly gods, that it might in fact be Ragnarok unfolding. Let them figure out those details for themselves when they send troops to join in. They couldn't fault the pilot for saying there were multiple hostiles, but it did add another note of urgency to our mission. If humans joined in and got raised from the dead with all their modern weaponry, well, it could quickly spiral out of control. Not that we had any sort of real control at the moment.
There, Mr. Druid, you see her?
What? No, where is she? Coyote pointed with his spear a tiny bit west of north.
Near the base of the mountain, just a touch that way.
I scanned the horde and saw nothing in particular that stood out. It could mean that I was simply missing her, or it could mean that Loki's mark was somehow disguising her even in the magical spectrum. Or it could mean that Coyote was messing with me for some reason. Not that he needed a reason, once I thought about it. Messing with me was reason enough for him to get out of bed in the morning. I don't see her.
Are you shitting me right now?
No, are you shitting me?
Damn. Whatever, we'll keep going.
Movement off to the right drew my gaze. Garm, the Hound of Hell, had just swung his head in our direction. He was staring right at us, it seemed, with those yellow eyes. His lip curled back from his teeth, and he growled. His nostrils flared, and he huffed a couple of times. Then his growl built until a low, booming woof rippled across the field to me.
You smell too good to him, Mr. Druid, like coffee and bacon in the morning.
He had to be right. There was no one else on the field that he'd recognize by scent. His muscles tensed, and he began an exploratory stride in our direction, nose twitching, trying to zero in on me. I tried an old trick that had worked on the Firbolgs once. I had the earth soften and then tighten around his paws to keep him immobile. But it failed because the earth was almost completely drained of juice near the portal. The land was going dead, and it didn't have the strength to hold on to Garm. But it did trip him, and he went down with a howl, crushing several Draugar underneath him, and perhaps getting stabbed with their weapons in the process. He'd be up in a moment, though, and pretty soon I'd be running out of juice to maintain my camouflage. I'd be visible and far away from any help in the middle of a sea of enemies.
That got her attention,
Coyote reported.
She's looking at her hound now.
She is? Coyote pointed once again with his spear.
She's the ugly one, looking toward the hound. All the rest are looking forward at the front lines.
Coyote's phrasing left me a bit at sea. If Hell was the ugly member of the undead, which was the beautiful? I still couldn't pick her out. His attempts to point to her were like waving at a colony of fire ants and saying, "That one!" But his assertion that she was interested in Garm gave me an idea. Okay, I'm going to keep messing with the hound and you keep leading us to her. If she's not paying attention to us, you might be able to get a free shot.
Okay, you try to keep us from getting eaten. I'll try not to lose sight of our target.
On the one hand, I didn't want to use any more of the Earth's energy, but on the other, it was going to get used anyway, and I also didn't want to die. Garm needed a distraction, so I gave him one. I bound a bunch of Draugr armor to his coat, all the leather stuff, which was in many cases connected to metal stuff and to the Draugr themselves. They could phase right out of it and probably would, but in a few seconds he had a lot of annoying extra weight on him, Draugr being lifted toward his body and vice versa, a tug in both directions every time I completed a binding. Garm must have thought the Draugr were attacking him, for he didn't take kindly to it, turning around and biting at them as if they were saucy jumbo fleas.
Attaboy,
Coyote said, and I thought he was talking to Garm at first, but then he added,
Keep that up. She's moving closer to him. We don't even have to change course.
I hoped he was right. I hoped we would be able to pull this off all sneaky, in and out, change the course of battle, and...
Uh-oh.
What?
She's looking around. She can smell the shenanigans.
Well, she can't see me, I said. Just as all the earth went dead beneath my feet, its energy drained away, and my camouflage fizzled. I could recast it, using stored energy from my bear charm, but I rather thought I'd need that for something else. I was quite visible and quite visibly alive in a sea of undead. And what's more, Hell spotted me right away and shrieked in recognition. That allowed me to finally locate her. She had taken the trouble to make herself look entirely rotted instead of only half-rotted, but her eyes held burning scleras, and if they indicated emotional heat, then she was ablaze. She'd once asked me to join her side for Ragnarok, and I'd refused. She'd been alone and outnumbered that day, and we chased her off. It would be safe to say that the circumstances had changed. I shoved Coyote forward as I drew Frogger on and said, "You're not with me now," hoping he'd get the idea that he should blend in. I kicked the Draugr to my right to clear some space and expected to be overwhelmed shortly from all sides. But instead, the Draugr pulled away from me and Coyote followed suit because hell was coming straight at me, charging down the mountain. Her assumed form of a Draugr melted and shifted until she was the deity I had seen and smelled before, half-living and half-skinless putrid corpse. She grew as she approached, taking longer and longer strides, topping 10 feet easily, and I had to rapidly reassess how I was going to fight someone that huge. The reach she now had far exceeded mine, and she had drawn her knife, Famine, out of her ribcage. Unlike Loki's sword, Famine did not grow in proportion to the rest of Hell, probably because Loki was casting an illusion there. But her knife was a significant piece of cutlery regardless. Hell's stench arrived in advance of her actual person, and it was enough to make me wistful for the smell of pears and braided elf hair. I blinked and coughed, trying to keep my wits, and took a tiny step back even as Hell grunted and her eyes widened. Her hands splayed out in a desperate bid for balance, but it was too late. Physics had asserted its mastery over her person because Coyote had expertly tripped her with the shaft of his spear as she passed him. She'd never expected to be tripped by one of her own Draugr, and I hadn't expected that either. The net result was that I scrambled away from her knife hand but couldn't avoid being flattened by the other one as she crashed to the ground. It knocked the wind out of me, and I remained still too long, a giant hand, Hell's flesh-covered one, wrapped itself around my body and picked me up, trapping my arm against my side so that Fragora was useless. She was still prone, so she didn't raise me too high, but she slammed me back to earth again, and it was less than gentle on my head. I saw lights blinking in my vision and felt nauseous, probably because she was bringing me up to her face and I got a lungful of her death breath. The side of her face that was exposed tissue and bone had wee maggots writhing in her cheek meat, and I first thought that those had to be distracting, and then wondered madly why she hadn't taken time to remove them on her big day.
"Do it," she rasped. "Die now."
She wasn't into small talk, just enough gloating for me to appreciate my own defeat. Her other hand, the bony one with Famine in it, approached, blade first. I felt the cold steel press against the warm flesh of my throat and then slide across, sawing me open. Blood and air escaped, and I silently triggered my healing charm as soon as she withdrew the blade, having no trouble at all relaying my panic in gurgles and wheezes, because I'd only bought myself a little bit of time. When the blood stopped flowing, she'd have at it again, and perhaps not content herself with merely slitting my throat. I had no options to retaliate, and she grinned with blackened teeth as my blood spilled onto her hand. Abruptly, her entire body jerked, including the hand with me in it, and her expression altered to one of surprise and then scrunched into a wince of pain. She began to shrink, and her hand could no longer wrap itself around my body. I flopped to the ground with all the grace of a stunned cod and hoped I'd be able to breathe and function again soon. But I saw a Draugr atop Hell's back with its spear sunk into her torso. He was twisting it around like a swizzle stick, tearing up her organs with a bladed tip.
"Hi there, Mr. Druid,"
Coyote called in his gravelly rasp.
"This has been fun, but I expect I'll be dying shortly. Looks like you will, too. She got your throat, eh? Well, at least I won't have to hear any more of your puns. And my people should be safe now."
Coyote will never gain a reputation for kind farewells, but at least he had his priorities straight. The Norse goddess of death expired with a hoarse rattle and one final spasm, and the entire army of Draugr flinched as one. At least all of them that I could see surrounding me. I don't know if they flinched at the front lines. But they didn't melt away or explode in a puff of ash, either. They looked around, as if waking from sustained somnambulism, bereft of Hell's guidance, and decided they weren't really eager to march forward to face an army intent on destroying them. They started looking around for exits, and they were not interested at all in me or Coyote or the lifeless stank of Hell.
"What's this now?"
Coyote said.
"None of these fellers cares what I did? Whip me up a batch of heart and lung marmalade right in front of them, using 100% rotten goddess ingredients, and they ain't even the least bit mad."
They wouldn't be. They had no loyalty to Hell. Her realm was where no one wanted to go, and she had never treated them well. A howl tearing through the sky reminded us that at least one creature was loyal to Hell, however.
"Oh, shit,"
Coyote said, which was what I was thinking, but couldn't say. Garm had freed himself of most, if not all, of the Draugar, and become aware that Hell was no more. He was a biggin', as they say, 12 feet tall, and even at a distance he could clearly see Coyote and me next to Hell's body. My throat closed up and my neck shortly thereafter, and I could breathe again and get some oxygen to my brain. I had enough juice for maybe one trick, and that was it.
"You got a plan, Mr. Druid?"
Coyote said. Garm showed his teeth and barked, his hackles raising. I gasped once and said,
"Run! Change your scent!"
"Don't gotta tell me twice! Bye!"
Coyote left his spear behind and hopped off the still form of Hell, streaking right into the confused mass of Draugar. Garm watched him go, but didn't watch for long. He turned to stare directly at me and growled. Mine was the scent he already knew, the one that had gotten away once upon a time. And now that he saw me next to the dead body of his mistress, he wasn't going to let me get away again. He sprang forward, scattering Draugar and knocking over any that didn't get out of the way in time. I had two choices, fight or run. If I stood and fought, it would be in a weakened state with little to no magic at my disposal to boost speed or strength, and unless I got the proverbial critical hit right from the start, my long life would end as a chew toy for a hellhound with a legitimate grudge. There was basically only one way to escape him, and it was by no means a safe option, but it involved a sacrifice as well. The odds of surviving were slightly higher, however, so I didn't hesitate. Using the last of my magic, I shape-shifted to a great horned owl and took wing directly away from Garm, rising to what I hoped was just above the height of a spear thrust. I didn't want to rise too high and make myself a clear target for Loki's bow or anyone else's. And though it hurt, I left Frogara behind, to be found and picked up by anyone, because I needed to achieve the full airspeed velocity of an unladen owl. That's about 40 miles per hour, and I'd never make it if I had to lug an awkward few pounds in my talons. As it was, I couldn't reach that speed right away. There was a whole lot of flapping that had to happen first, and there were no magical bursts. Garm had a head start on getting up to speed, and an aggressive woof told me he'd seen me take flight and was on my literal tail now, and he was closing the distance between us rather than me opening it up. I might be snatched out of the air, a nice snack for him. There was nothing for me to do but keep calm and flap on, a phrase that is not emblazoned across T-shirts everywhere for good reason. Noise grew behind me as Garm drew closer, hoarse cries of undead surprise as the Draugar were mowed down, the baying of Garm himself as he tried to catch up, and the crunch and clatter of collisions. The Draugar were slowing him down at least a little bit, preventing him from reaching top speed, but he was still getting closer. I could feel it. And then I realized that the Draugar could probably help me out quite a bit. Most of them were in retreat, heading around the base of the volcano to see what was on the other side. As a result, Garm was running into their flank. If I turned into the Draugar, though, and flew toward the Fae and the Norse and others, I might be able to capitalize on their instinct. Garm's breath blew hot and snotty on my tail feathers, and that's when I banked sharply left, directly over the heads of the retreating Draugar. They're not trained fighters, necessarily, like the Einherjar, but when something is coming at you and you have a sharp stick to poke at it, chances are you're going to use it if you can't get out of the way in time. That's what I was counting on. Garm overshot me on the sharp turn and I gained some ground, but he halted and came after me, and in so doing he encountered some fierce resistance. The Draugr weren't obeying Hel now, so they gave her hound no breaks. They saw a big dog, and they didn't want to get run over, so with the tips of their spears, they tried to discourage him from doing that. Since he wasn't paying attention to the Draugr, he ran right into more than a few of those spear tips. It slowed him down, and he yelped a couple of times, eventually giving up to attend to his many wounds. I banked to the right, heading for the far side of the battlefield.